Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Mradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Joining us now as part of our continuing coverage of the Surface Navy Association's virtual national symposium earlier this year are Rear Admiral Paul Schleiss, the U.S. Navy's Director of Surface Warfare, and Major General Tracy King, the Services Director of Expeditionary Warfare. We are an SNA media partner, and our coverage is sponsored by Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, GE Marine, and Leonardo DRS. Gentlemen, thanks so very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Vago. Thank you.
Hey, Vago. Yeah, great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Great to have you guys back on. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Admiral Schleiss, I want to start with you. The Navy, sir, has a very ambitious integrated shipbuilding plan that's going to require significant resources. Obviously, it's a new administration, and the service is going to have to make that case as the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin balances each service's needs. What's the case for more resources, and what are the trade-offs and risks necessary to get there, right? Because at the end of the day, you're going to have to make calls and potentially shrink the force in order to grow it downstream.
Wow, great question and a complex question. As with every budget build, that you know, tough choices have to be made. There's always more that we want, that the fleet wants in terms of capability and capacity than we have in our budget and our ability to afford. So that's an every year budget drill that we do here in the building, and that's the job of the OPNAV staff to look at all those priorities, you know, as dictated by the National Defense Strategy, and you know, more recently in the the Tri-Service Maritime Strategy, and the CNO's NAV plan, and get those priorities teed up at the top of the list that are the needle movers and the capabilities that we need the most out there. In some cases, CNO, the previous CNO and CNO Gilday are both on record as the top Navy priority is Columbia. The Ohio class is aging out, and it's just time to recapitalize there. So that is the number one fry on the shipbuilding list, and that program's not in my orbit, but very important, and obviously at the top of the priority list. And we've heard CNO talk quite a bit about the naval operational architecture as a high priority of his, and the need for and really the surface warfare piece of that is, our upgraded and our more modern surface combatants and the ability to tie those together through an integrated combat system. So we have, and that's a new-ish item on our want list, but something that we have in our out years budgets, and we're working together on the plans, the requirements for what that system will be that will tie all our platforms together and help us fight more effectively in a distributed maritime ops or otherwise known as DMO in that format, in that way, as we take the fight forward.
The Navy has large fleets of legacy systems while at the same time seeking to develop three major new initiatives, right? The large surface combatant, the large unmanned platforms, as well as the light amphibious warship, the new smaller warship that the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, wants to move 75 Marines more effectively in a distributed amphibious force, relying less on large amphibs. But there are serious concerns on the Hill whether the Navy can deliver. And a lot of folks point out to problems with Ford. That carrier has yet to deploy. The Zumwalt being seen as, still no gun, for example, as well as not yet on a deployment cycle. And then the LCS, right? Three of these programs have been sort of seen as debacles by many people on the Hill. How do you reassure lawmakers the Navy is going to get it right with these very big high-end systems? How does the Navy win back credibility on these?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's I think it's very well documented in the press and you know in our own internal Navy reports that we did some things that we may have made different decisions now in the fullness of time in terms of how we procured and really proved it to ourselves from an engineering perspective. You know, on the Ford elevators or, you know, the 11 critical technologies, new technologies that were rolled into Zumwalt. And I think the short answer is lessons learned. And we've got to, and we have taken all those lessons, some of them tough lessons on board. And we're rolling that into our processes for procuring the new platforms. And you listed some of those. And I'll add FFGX to that, or FFG-62, the Constellation class. I mean, there's an example of we didn't start with a clean sheet of paper. We started with a ship that's in service with several NATO partners and took the best of what they have there and then improved upon that design. And we got industry involved early. And we had a competition. We ended up picking the best of breed, the one we liked the best. And that just happens to be built by Fincantieri, who we've got some experience with. So that's an example of us using, and we're not rolling in a bunch of new again. We're gonna use a version of the SPY-6 radar. We're gonna use a version of the Aegis combat system. So there's inherent risk reduction there rather than you're creating a completely new combat system as we did with the DDG 1000 class. We're reusing some things that have been around for a while and have been improved over the course of time that, you know, starting with Aegis Baseline 1 that was on CG-47, we're generations beyond that. And it's just grown and gotten better over the course of time. So we're rolling those lessons learned into, you know, how we've developed the requirements for the ship, gotten industry involved earlier to help us work the problem and work the, you know, get them comfortable with the design, have them give us their feedback on what they can and can't do, and or how we could do it better. And that's all been rolled into this process in a team approach with government, industry, and on the Navy side, on the requirements and the acquisition side, working closely together. On the planning. So I'm confident. I'm bullish on FFG-62. I'm bullish on DDG-51 Flight 3, which is actually going to come out before the first Connie class frigate. DDG-51 is a very familiar ship type to us, but the Flight 3 is quite a different platform with the incorporating SPY-6, the air and missile defense radar, and Aegis Baseline 10. So that's the next generation. And that ship's going to come out. It's due to deliver in 23. So yeah, that's kind of the next thing. But again, it's been an incremental upgrade. Flight 3 is over the baseline Flight 2 Alpha, which is a long standing workhorse in the fleet. Over.
Admiral Schleitz, the Navy tends to get more excited about performance and firepower sometimes than mundane issues like maintenance, but maintenance is really what's tying up the fleet. So this is kind of a two-part question. First, newer platforms give you an opportunity to field something more reliable, easier to repair, increasing your efficiency while also reducing the burden on sailors. How are you going to be designing sustainability and ease of maintenance into these new generation ships, whether the Constellation, whether the large surface combatant and the large unmanned platforms, to allow you, right? Because the Navy sometimes designs stuff that's kind of hard to maintain, you know, is maybe performance driven, but then becomes sort of the bane of sailors at the end of the day and contributes to your maintenance backlog.
Swoboss, Vice Admiral Kitchener talked a lot about this in recent weeks, but he, as the waterfront guy and the leader of the surface community, he's really got that dot. And he has, our role is to support him with the resources that he needs to do that. But in terms of upgrades to ships, I think we've come a long way there. And as I mentioned, the integrated combat system earlier, the what we're talking about there is installing a computing infrastructure that's easily upgraded, that doesn't involve a bunch of hull cuts to install a whole bunch of new hardware every time. The computing infrastructure and computing technology has moved to the point where we can install install a server rack essentially, and then as new technology, faster computers come out, we don't have to make those massive hull cuts in the ship that drive lengthy yard periods and big cabinets that don't fit through a standard Navy hatch. That's I think the place where we want to get to be able to install upgrades much more simply and with less time wake. But the last thing we want to do is get our ships into lengthy yard periods that are tough for the crew, and it's tough to bring the ship back, get it spooled up in its training and certifications and ready to deploy again. That's kind of the crux of your question here, I think. And so that's one of the things that we're doing in terms of our new ship design that will make upgrades easier in the future. And it's absolutely something that we are rolling into all that we're thinking about and talking about with respect to DDGX, the next large surface combatant.
Right.
In terms of maintenance, we've gotten smarter on this. We've shifted to more of and all the old Navy salts that listen into this are familiar with PMS, the plan maintenance system and maintaining systems. We've shifted more to a condition-based maintenance model, and we're getting some help on industry on how to continue to refine the processes that we use to plan and execute maintenance. Do you really need to tear down a piece of gear on the frequency that we've been doing it, or do you have some monitoring equipment that lets you know when the right time is to do that? So incorporating some more technology into the condition-based maintenance is where we're headed, and had plenty of good discussions with industry over the past months on what they can do to continue helping us as we march along that path.
General King, let me bring you into the conversation. Commandant Berger is seeking to reimagine the Corps, obviously for the threats it's going to face in the Pacific. That's the same thing that your counterpart, the N-95, also is doing. One is the light amphibious warship, the small amphib able to carry about 75 Marines for this distributed Marine force. Critics, however, are concerned that it's going to take us too long to field these new ships, right? And in part because we never hit our amphibious ship goal. We don't hit our ship goals. We, as a Marine, I'm sure you're familiar that we've never really had as many amphibs as we need to do what it is we say we need to do. Yeah. History's proven, though, that Marines on small ships can do a lot, right? And that's part of the idea behind this concept. But historically, Marines were aboard surface combatants as well. We stopped doing that about 20 years ago. Is it time to, wouldn't it be better to return Marines to cruisers and destroyers, immediately using available capability, then modifying the 16 Independence class littoral combat ships, given that they've got vast internal volume, gigantic flight decks, and use them for this mission instead of developing an entirely new class of ship?
Let me go back to the premise of the question, which I think is a good one. The Navy built the world's finest amphibious fleet inside of the world's finest Navy because that's what the Marine Corps asked them to do. And we built it against, the threat that was at the time. And that fleet consists of very large, very capable, the most capable in the world, very expensive, and very few in number amphibious ships. So the problem that emanates from what I just described is the one that you laid out there. Because they are so expensive, we never are going to be able to have the number that we need. So when you take that with our analysis of the coming fight, where we do need to be more distributed, we do need to be just as lethal or even more lethal, but we need to do it in a distributed fashion, then that leads you kind of back to the future, which is smaller, more affordable, much more plentiful ships, which is, as you rightfully described, a light amphibious warship. Is the Marine Corps asking the Navy to build a different fleet? No, we're asking the Navy and working with the Navy to evolve the existing fleet, which is adding relatively large numbers of less smaller vessels that less tonnage, but with much more capability, which is the light amphibious warship. But the light amphibious warship is not a replacement for the existing Lima class ships. There's the need for the United States, for the Joint Force, for the United States Navy to conduct forcible entry operations remains. And that's why we're going to maintain the right amount of large amphibious ships so that we can do, you know, what's commonly referred to as JFAO. But, you know, to kind of get back to the last part of your question, I don't know that I agree with putting, Marines back on cruisers and back on destroyers. The mission of those platforms is sea control, or it's evolving to sea control, changing to sea control. I think that we can best serve the Navy by doing what the Marine Corps does best. That is as an extension of the Navy, to come at a time and place of our choosing, using the sea as maneuver space, project power over the shore, and evolve that ability to project power to enhance the Navy's objective of sea control. So that is where we can do that, and where we can best do that from is from, I think, from the amphibious platforms and from the light amphibious warship that we're building. To the last point in your question, Vago, I am eyeball deep in trying to get the law off the ground. I think that we are moving very quickly. We patterned the design of building this light amphibious warship off of the frigate design, which is very successful. I have high hopes, and I would put a paycheck on it that we're going to lay the keel on the first one in the next 2 years. And then we're going to start building them in pretty significant quantities very soon after that. That is fast. So, today, back of the napkin, it takes 5 years to build a DDG. It takes 5 years to build an LPD. We're probably going to build, we're going to build these in 12 to 18 months, which is, to me, that's pretty damned quick. And when we do ramp up production, I fully suspect that our partners and allies are really going to be enticed by this platform. You know it as well as I do. 2,000 tons, 400 foot, $100 million, can haul around those numbers of Marines you were talking about, serve as a tactical maneuver platform. The Marines can actually live on it. That sounds like something Australia would really like. That sounds like something Japan would really like. That sounds like something that a lot of South and Central American countries would really like. So I see FMS coming in very significantly and driving the price point down, driving the speed of production up, maybe even going, and talking to my NAVSEA brothers, the ship's architects, we're already beginning to discuss using more than one yard.
Let me ask a follow-up question to that, sir. So there's the idea of developing and building the ship, but then again, the question is how this fits into an operational concept forward, right? And the weapons that you need. The Marines have been trying, and it is each of the military services, to extend the range, to extend that firepower, as Bob Ork was fond of saying, sort of outsticking the enemy. And at this point, the enemy does have longer sticks than we do. Talk to us a little bit about how this ship fits into that integrated vision and the kind of firepower you guys are going to need in order to support these operations and where you are on the development of the operational concept that actually will help realize what it is you want to do and how.
The light amphibious warship, just like the Lima class ships, will always operate as an extension of the fleet. So, dependent upon what the threat scenario is, if it's steady state today, assuring partners and allies, presence operations, I see the light amphibious warship operating independently. It's going to have long legs. It's going to be interacting with our partners and allies, and the Marines are going to be out there practicing with it. Yeah, when we get indications and warnings that, the storm clouds are coming, I see the light amphibious warship, just like the big deck amphibs, being nestled underneath the protective umbrella of the fleet. I do not see them operating alone in a contested environment. To me, that's a fool's errand. But just like we're doing on the L-class ships, We are really working with the Marine Corps, specifically Lieutenant General Eric Smith and his guys at CDNI, on uncoiling the lethality that's resident in the Marine Air Ground Task Force while we're in transit. And that's a new thing. So we do it with the fixed-wing aviation, you know, every day. We're really starting to do it with rotary-wing aviation, which I think is where we can get the most bang for the buck. But, you know, your Marine Corps, your MAGTAF, VAGO is very, very lethal. And when we uncoil and get in on somebody, it's a sight to see. The Commandant has told us, hey, we want to be able to, let's make that available to the ship's captain. So working that out is what we're doing right now. So think containerized weapon systems. Think plug and play. You know, think the ship's captain having additional batteries, whether it's counter UAS, counter air, anti-ship, going against back FIAC, which will be is always a persistent threat in littorals. And we're working on that. Over.
Let me ask Admiral Schleiss the next question and bring the conversation back to him. How do you respond to critics who question the Zumwalt, for example, right? It has yet to deploy the littoral combat ship, in part because it doesn't have a gun. We're still trying to work out a solution to that problem. The littoral combat ship, which has been lacking some mission modules. I've got a follow-up to General King about this on the expeditionary side, because the mine module is critical, and that's not yet moving as quickly, I think, as everybody wants. The ASW module isn't yet there. And then folks are now also questioning the services unmanned plans. How do you answer the critics really briefly across each of those platforms when folks look at that and say, wow, this represents tens of billions of dollars of investment and many, many more billions more. And, you know, a little bit of the concern that some of this stuff is spending a lot of time tied up to peers as opposed to having water under the keel.
Right. Good question, Vago. Thank you. Let's talk about 1000. That's a program that was initially planned for 32 ships, and through a series of decisions and long predate my presence here as a director, that we ended up with three. So the you talk about the gun, when you're going to have 32 ships and the number of rounds that you're going to build for those guns, it's pretty appealing, I think, to industry and potential competitors, because there's a lot of that's a lot of work for them and a lot of jobs for their employees and opportunity to make a few bucks. When we cut the class all the way down to three, now you're talking about a much smaller amount, much smaller quantities, and overall less appealing program. And then the cost per round goes up as well too. So that's the sort of and that's just one example of several that have given that program some challenges. That said, those ships, we love how that propulsion plant operates. It's and that is serving as, again, I talked about lessons learned earlier. That's serving as risk reduction and learning for us as we talk about the propulsion plant that we'll put on DDGX. So we are capitalizing on that and learning from that integrated power system and applying it to planning for the next large surface combatant. In terms of mission, we changed the mission for 1000 to long range surface strike. And this is pre-decisional, but there's, you probably have read and heard about, and CNO even talked about the desire to put hypersonic weapons on it. So that's something that we're taking a hard look at, and it looks like that ship class can support them. So we'll see how things play out with the next couple of budgets here, but that's something we're very interested in. And the ship's got, a ton of capability there and, all the other great capabilities that we've learned about in terms of, I'll just stay on the propulsion plant, we're really happy with those. So, you know, let's give those ships a chance, give those sailors that are still ringing out a brand new platform, they'll get some runtime and eventually some forward deployments under their belt. And I think we're going to like what we get out of that class. Yeah. As for LCS, yeah, there's, the challenges with the propulsion plant in the Freedom variant are well documented. I don't see many articles written about Gabby Gifford's great deployment last year, though. And, she went forward, had a nice deployment out in 7th Fleet, for the first time, brought Naval Strike Missile and over the horizon capability in that platform. And the fleet commanders love it. And we're stepping on the gas to get more of that on more of our LCSs. So a great lesson learned there that we're applying. And then Gabby got back to her home port in San Diego and then repumped pretty quickly again to operate in 4th Fleet. So there's some positive stories out there with LCS. Yes, we have to get after those things that are nipping us in the heels with respect to reliability and the propulsion plant challenges that we're still coming through. But you're going to see more deployments going forward here, and the ship's operations are going to keep ramping up. So there's some good news out there too.
The follow up though to that is right that a lot of folks. The response from critics would be the Navy always points to Gabby Giffords going out and doing stuff, but then what about the 20 some odd other ships that are not doing it, right? Constituting kind of a big investment at the end of the day. And each year, N95s have been telling us, you know, this year is going to be the year of the LCS where we're going to be able to get out there in mass. I mean, is that something that's going to happen this year? Is it something realistically next year? I mean, what's the plan to make sure that these ships are kind of haze gray and underway in the kind of numbers and percentages that you get for your DDG force or you're expecting to get out of the new 62 class?
Yeah, thanks, Vago. I think we're just going to have to show you because talk is cheap. And we can't discuss deployment schedules here on this net, but we're going to have to show you. There's plans for much more operational time for the class, and we got to prove that to ourselves and to the Congress and to everyone. So I'm bullish on it. I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to execute as scheduled going forward here and get some more operational time. Continue to learn and get better. The ships will be more maintainable, more sustainable as we continue to get more runtime. But we got to show you, bottom line, we got to prove it.
General King, let me give you the last question. Expeditionary warfare is about getting close, and getting close means that people on beaches shoot at you or you've got to deal with mines, not to put too fine a point on it. And that's an issue that your predecessors have worked as well. Give us your sense on where and what the mine roadmap now is, and how you guys are thinking through the contested space, right? I mean, at the end of the day, an ever more availability of precision munitions from the beach do complicate your ability to get folks onto it.
Right. Yeah, good question. So, you know, land warfare and maritime mine warfare, you know, have some similarities. You know, the similarities to a defense in depth, maritime coastal defense in depth is that, you know, they use obstacles, they use mines to enhance the lethality of weapon systems. So, you know, we're very fond of saying, and I've actually seen this in action, you know, a minefield that's not covered by fire really isn't a minefield. So you're right. This is an area of concern. Operating in, you know, shallow water, very shallow water and deep water against a peer adversary who proliferates mines is a extremely complicated, difficult problem. And that's why they do it. But, you know, Vago, mine warfare is about time. So it's about, you know, time in relation to your adversary, which, you know, by the doctrinal term for that is tempo. So our adversary, we're pretty sure, is going to use mine warfare to slow us down so that they can achieve their objectives. And what we have done is we are shifting to the mine warfare packages on the littoral combat ships and on vessels of opportunity, because we the way that we do maritime countermine right now is we actually put men inside the minefield. We put men and women, we put sailors inside the minefield with some pretty unique ships that are really good at hovering, and they go and they hunt mines in the minefield. And we actually do it pretty well. But we're going to do that same thing, but we're not going to put the sailor in the minefield. And that's kind of the fundamental difference. The other thing that we're focused in on is what I consider the most important part of operational maneuver and effective tactical maneuver, and that is minefield avoidance. So wide area detection, proving to the Joint Force Commander or the fleet commander that, hey, there's a minefield here, or hey, there's not a minefield here, and then he decides, I avoid it, I neutralize it, or you know what, based on what we're doing, we have to go through it. And we're going to begin fielding the MCM packages in 23 and 24. They're being put together right now. The first two, not completely full packages, are actually going out next year. So I mean, they're being produced, they're in the works. That will give us the ability, when the Joint Force Commander says, hey, I have to go through that minefield, to number one, find it, define its leading edge, and then to be able to clear, several dozen nautical miles in a period of time so that the fleet continue to maneuver. Over.
Gentlemen, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. You've been very generous with your time. General, I know you were just in a high-level meeting and broke away to join us, so I really appreciate it. Thanks very much, and look forward to having you guys back on both together again as well as individually.
Hey, thanks, Vago. Really appreciate your time, too, and all that you do to get the Navy story out there.
Thanks, Vago. Look forward to talking to you again.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.